When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. The Supreme Court, 6-3, the majority ruling that the Grutter case from 2003 is now, to paraphrase Justice Thomas, effectively overruled. I welcome Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, because affirmative action in the United States has a long history, at least beginning with the end of the Civil War in the middle of the 19th century. It is part of the tragedy of America that the founding fathers were not able to overcome the resistance of the slaveocracy that eventually led to the catastrophe of the Civil War. We're still living with the outcome of that war in terms of the 14th Amendment, the Equal Protection Clause, and in terms of the Freedmen's Bureau, which was an effort by the then radical Republicans in the Congress who controlled it to account for the brutality visited on African Americans in the previous decades. Mm-hmm. And also, the court ever since then has zigzagged in its opinion of what is to be done with the brutality visited upon those who are regarded as not first rate, not first class citizens. Professor, a very good evening to you. I begin with the Civil War because the 14th Amendment is a direct result, a part of the victory of the Civil War. The current court, led by Justice Roberts, is writing that the way to end discrimination is to end discrimination. How did we get here, Professor, beginning with the 14th Amendment? Why is it that we're still arguing about this? Good evening to you.
Well, good evening. Well, it's a very difficult thing. You started with the 14th Amendment, but you started with the back end of it, not the front end of it. And the front end of this is the first clause, which overruled Dred Scott, which essentially said that blacks were inherently so inferior that they could not be counted as citizens of the United States. When it says that every person born in the United States essentially is a citizen thereof and of the state in which they reside. So that was the first part. And then what they did to these new citizens is they gave them a set of rights called privileges and immunities. And this is a fairly large and extensive list of rights having to do with various kinds of civil capabilities. It's basically a kind of a libertarian sort of provision, which stresses the right to contract, the right to own property, the right to leave money to individuals, testify in court, sue and be sued, and so forth. And this privileges and immunities clause was read in a case called Slaughterhouse so narrowly that the only thing that it protected was the right to petition the government and to send a boat up a navigable water. And at the same time, you had huge amounts of utterly disgusting racial behavior in many states, massacres of black people who wanted to do this. And the Supreme Court said that there was nothing that the federal government could do to protect people from these sorts of assaults because privileges and immunities did not cover this. And so what it had to do is leave it to the states. And that meant the very people who crookedly won the elections were the people who could then prosecute and take after black citizens who were systematically excluded, terrorized, and so forth. So the first part that what we see about the Civil War is you have this fairly powerful amendment with really kind of laudable ideals. And what you do is you see it being systematically gutted, first in the privileges and immunities area, and then the Cruikshank case, which had to do with criminal punishment, and then with Plessy v. Ferguson. So this is not a very promising beginning. And there are some arguments there that resonate today, although they're completely wrong in that context, which is, well, we've gotten rid of slavery. Just how long do we have to worry about the lingering after effects? And Justice Harlan, in his civil rights dissent in 1883, took the principle that we have to worry about it for a very long time. The majority, particularly by the time you've got Plessy, said it's running the argument of slavery into the ground to think that it has anything to do with segregated schools and the like. So the United States was put into a very bad position because of the way in which the amendments were gutted. Question is, why were they gutted? Well, there are a whole variety of sociological reasons. There's large amounts of systematic racism in the United States, in the South and in the North, which lasted perhaps up to the Civil War, not the World War II and so forth. As in the last 80 or so years, I think it's abated a great deal, but there was that stuff. There was also the weaknesses of the American constitutional structure. But the American constitutional structure was equipped to do was to handle coercion that was applied by the government. And the Equal Protection Clause, which applies to all persons, not just citizens, all persons, was designed to make sure you could not have selective prosecution based on race. You couldn't go too hard on black citizens or black people, and you couldn't go too soft on white people. And the same thing was true with aliens and everybody else. The criminal guarantees went to persons. They didn't go to citizens. But what the Constitution never dealt with adequately at the time is how does the government distribute benefits? You mentioned the Freedmen's Bureau. The thing to remember about that is the letter D in the word freedmen. These were people who had been slaves who were then freed, right? And the question is, what do you do with them? And there was nobody but nobody at the time of the civil rights when the radical Republicans ruled who thought that you could only use race-neutral benefits rules. 30 acres and a plow or 40 acres and a plow, all of this stuff is specifically race-based. All was based on a quite credible sense of what counted as restitution to a group of people who had been slaves. This is not restitution, California style today. This is a very different thing. And those things went through fairly well. Segregation was then reimposed in an iron kind of way. And so by the time you got to 1912-13, when Woodrow Wilson resegregates the civil service, the newly found NAACP from 1910 to even bother to challenge it in court. So powerful were the precedents. And then you really have to claw your way back. What's the dominant rule of clawing your way back if the year is 1935? You don't argue for racial preferences. You argue for a colorblind system. And it was pushed very, very hard in the Supreme Court. And what they said is, we now have overt discriminations against black people. We have to get rid of these things. Let's do it. But only with all deliberate speed. So everything kind of got slowed down in the political stuff because the remedies were very hard to impose. In fact, they could not be imposed judicially. It took the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and most importantly, the ability of the federal government to withhold funding from southern states that refused to desegregate their schools in order to get the particular change. So if you look at somebody like Justice Roberts, he sees this as a colorblind revolution. You look at anybody else, and at the very time the colorblind principle managed to really take hold, we had the race riots in the United States in the 1960s. Detroit, Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, Washington, you name it, they were huge upset. And there were many people who said, we've just got to move more rapidly than this, so let's have some kind of affirmative action program. For 15 years, these programs were stymied in labor unions and everything else where there was systematic discrimination. And in Weber, Justice Brennan writes a very weak opinion explaining that it's okay to do this within limits, but we don't know what the limits are. And so what you do is you see in the United States two warring tendencies. The Justice Roberts one is, we have an abstract set of principles that mean only colorblindness makes sense. And then you have people who are much more seriously concerned with and engaging in the social history, who said either you do something about the past or it's going to come back to consume you. And that battle still exists today on the Supreme Court. So Brown was colorblind. And now the last thing that the progressive left wants is a colorblind system. And Justice Roberts insists upon it. And I think both sides are wrong. If you look at the constitutional structure, it's very well built for dealing with coercion. It's not so well built for dealing with the distribution of benefits, either in public universities or anywhere else. The general rule that we've had is when the government gives discretion on benefits, they have to have a little bit more wiggle room than when they're imposing the laws. It's not at all clear to me that the 14th Amendment, by its plain text, requires that there's no give. The First Amendment having to do with freedom of speech, has different rules for government employees and government grants than it does with respect to regulation. That can be carried over here. So you now have this very unfortunate situation historically. You have the American left, which is pushing affirmative action far further than anybody even conceived that it could be done when cases like Bakke were decided in the 1970s, sort of overt racial requirements of one kind or another, put into place by highly politicalized faculties in the universities, which are in many cases, particularly amongst the younger people, 90-95% very far to the left, against the general American public, which is much more conservative on all of these issues. And so what you see is two opinions, Justice Roberts, Chief Justice, a little bit too rigid, Justice Sotomayor, a little bit too hysterical. You have these rules. If you had a colorblind standard, things would certainly change. But to say that this would be a return to segregation basically overstates the consequences of the change and trivializes the downright evil associated with these earlier systems. And it's just very hard to figure out how you find some wiggle room if you're a lone voice in the middle saying you've got to do something, but you can't do too much. And you have two tectonic forces pulling at you, one saying you've got to just simply allow anything to go, and the other saying you can't do anything at all. I mean, this is not a gap that can be easily bridged, but I think if you start looking at the history, the really bad turn towards segregation in the aftermath of the Civil War has made it very difficult to correct the processes thereafter. And now the change in the American political composition as such has created two very different groups, a very powerful liberal group inside the universities and now increasingly in major boardrooms and so forth, and a large public which is disenchanted with the way in which these privileged people manage to fight over something which they regard as patently unfair.
Speaking with Professor Richard Epstein, who does us the favor of bringing us up to date to the decision by the Supreme Court in these last hours to end or recant or reject what is called the doctrine of affirmative action. When we come back, the word colorblind, Professor used in two ways, from the right and from the left. And the decision now turns on another thing that happened in 2003 in Grutter versus Bollinger, 25 years. We're 5 years short of those 25 years. Does that signify in this contest? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Bash.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.